This is a production of Cornell University.
Meeting will come to order. This is the fourth meeting for the spring 2012 semester for the Cornell Graduate and Professional Student Assembly. It is March 5th, and it is currently 5:34 p.m. Welcome, everybody. We have a very full agenda today, featuring two resolutions that amend some important documents, as well as, you'll know from some emails I sent earlier this week, an election to fill a vacancy on the voting body. So that's exciting. First item on the agenda is the roll call of voting members. Randa Adra. Here. Kyle Albert. Brian Alkemeyer.
Here.
Stephen Ahn.
Here.
Nicole Baran.
Here.
YJ Chen.
Here.
John Chechelewski.
Here.
Evan Cortens here. Andrew Elliott.
Here.
Carl Furkenhoff.
Here.
Marquise Hawkins.
Here.
Yevgeny Israelit,
here.
James Keach,
here.
Allison Nash,
here.
Rebecca Robbins,
here.
Eric Smith,
here.
Mia Tuto,
here.
Michelle White, Krista Wilson,
here.
Oh, so close. Oh. Next on the agenda is the approval of the minutes. Are there any corrections to the minutes as circulated over email? Rebecca. Mental health and welfare? Okay, so if we just place University Council with University Council on Mental Health and Welfare, that's good. Student, okay. University Council on Student Mental Health and Welfare. Excellent. Are there any objections? Seeing none, the minutes are so amended. Are there any further corrections to the minutes? James? Ah, thank you. Excellent. Any objections? Seeing none, minutes are so amended. Are there any further corrections to the minutes? Seeing none, is there any objection to the approval of the minutes? Seeing none, the minutes are approved. We move now to reports of officers and committee updates. I will now recognize myself, executive committee. A couple of points. One is that we've been talking a little bit about elections. I know that when I first got involved, I was sort of taken a little by surprise when elections suddenly started happening. So I think that the sooner we can get out a little bit of information about how this process works, the better. The GPSA does its elections for the next cycle, so that's 2012-2013, June 1st to May 31st. In two rounds at our last two meetings of the year. At April 9th, we caucus by division, so that's humanities, biological sciences, social sciences, and physical sciences, and each caucus chooses among itself its representatives. So each division is allocated a certain number of representatives. It's three for the humanities, three for the biological sciences, four for the physical sciences, I think at least one of which must be in an engineering program and at least one of which must be in a non-engineering program, and then four from the one that I haven't mentioned yet, social sciences. If they don't, in the context of that caucus, fill all of those seats, then the seat is thrown open at large, which is the wonderful poetic language of our charter. Thrown open it is, which means that anybody can then run for that seat. By way of example, that's what happened this past year. Biological sciences only had two representatives, so we did an at-large election, and that's when Allison was elected. The three professional schools elect their own representatives by their own internal process. That's not part of the caucusing system. This is only for the 16 members that represent programs administered by the graduate school. Does that make sense? Yeah. So 2 weeks after that, on April 23rd, we elect our officers. So we start by electing a new president, and then we go on down the line. Executive vice president for operations. We elect five committee chairs, and then we elect two representatives to the university assembly. All other committee staffing is done in the fall. So those, all of those elections, both the officer elections and the caucus ones, are open to the, they're elected by the entire membership. Field representatives get to vote in both of those elections. Within a caucus, they get to vote as part of at-large elections, as you'll see tonight, of course, because we're doing one of those, and they also get to vote for the officers. So basically, in conclusion, I would say that the sooner you start thinking about potential involvement for next year, the better. Certainly, as I've said in this room before, one of the issues facing student governance, not just on this campus but everywhere, is high turnover and making sure that we can effectively ensure that information is transferred from session to session. The less duplication of effort we have to do, the better. Any other questions about the GPSA election process? James. Yes. One other meeting. So that's 3 weeks from today, which is the 23rd? 26th, yeah.
Do you have to be a voting member to be potentially eligible to be an officer?
You have to be a voting member in order to be on the executive, so the president, executive vice president, or vice president for operations. You don't have to be a voting member to be a member of the university assembly or to chair a committee.
You don't have to be a field member either?
No. Exhibit A. Chris Heckman is neither a voting member or a field member, and is a committee chair. Any other questions about that? Seeing none, I wanted to mention trustee elections. I'll turn the floor over to Chris for a moment.
Hi, I'm on the student-elected trustee, or just the trustee nominating committee for the university, and for me, tomorrow to finalize dates as to the calendar for running for trustee. However, right now I have some draft dates, and these will be finalized and posted on the office of the website on the trustee nominating digital page by Wednesday afternoon, so you can check it then. But right now, if you're interested in running, I'm not the person to talk to, probably one of the currently sitting trustees, student trustees, is the first best person to talk to. But there's an info session coming, or a series of info sessions coming up next week, Monday and Wednesday in the evenings. And location and the exact times will be on that calendar that's up on Wednesday. And then right after the break, right after the spring break, March 28th is what is currently set to the sort of initial packet for running for the student elected trustee position is going to be due. And there's going to be a mandatory educational session that same day in the afternoon. So if you're interested in doing this, it's a great opportunity, as I understand it, and I think that you should definitely pursue talking with people about it and asking kind of what's involved and making sure you're apprised of the deadlines, because if you miss a deadline, then you most likely will be disqualified. So that's pretty much all I have to say for now.
A part of that packet is that you have to collect signatures from 200 graduate and professional students. I think that the packet will be online as soon as the timeline is online, which is very soon.
Yeah, I anticipate Wednesday evening at the latest. So. But yeah, the signatures, is that petition signatures, and those are necessary as well. So that's the biggest time to say for that first packet.
Okay. So when do we know?
I mean, I would say check it on Wednesday evening, but I can have somebody send an email if you feel that would be appropriate.
You forward something to the list, maybe? Does that make sense?
You can do that. We'll do that. Thank you.
Excellent. Any other questions about running for graduate student elected trustee? Of course, if you have questions, a great person to talk to is Derek Nighthawk Evanson, who's our current grad student elected trustee, or Alex Boris, our current undergraduate student elected trustee. Excellent. Seeing no further questions, sorry, I'm not texting. I'm trying to find my notes for the next thing on the agenda. So I sent you an email this afternoon. Probably many of you haven't had a chance to look at it yet. This is very important. I've drafted a little sort of blurb that I'll just read for you. As most of you probably know, back in April, maybe most of you don't know, this is a blurb from something else. Back in April, the Department of Education's Office of Civil Rights, OCR, issued a Dear Colleague letter to the Institutes of Higher Education in this country. In this letter, they clarified their understanding of Title IX as it applies to sexual harassment and sexual violence on university campuses. Title IX is a section of the Education Amendments from 1974, I believe, which says that your full participation in education cannot be abridged on account of your gender. It's often applied with regard to sports, for instance. That's where it may be familiar to you. OCR is now saying, of course, that sexual harassment, something that happens on the basis of gender, can affect, shall we say, your full participation in a university. Upon receipt of this letter, University Counsel's Office identified several areas of our campus code of conduct that they believe are incompatible with OCR's letter. Most of these are fairly straightforward and uncontentious, but two particular issues have proven more difficult, namely burden of proof and appeal rights. On burden of proof, our campus code currently requires clear and convincing evidence, which is roughly 80% certainty of guilt. And OCR requires a preponderance of the evidence, which means more likely to be guilty than not, you know, 50% plus one. On appeal rights, our campus code currently limits the appeal rights of the complainant in certain ways, and OCR says that that can't be the case. The complainant needs the same appeal rights. Responding to these concerns, the UA quickly amended the campus code last April with the understanding that the Codes and Judicial Council would look at this in more detail this semester. This semester, the CJC continues to explore different ways of dealing with this issue. One option is simply to move disputes involving sexual harassment and sexual violence where the accused person is a student into a separate policy, likely modeled after policy 6.4, which currently governs all disputes where the accused is not a student. The other approach, which has come to be known as the Princeton model, as they are the most prominent institution to have adopted it, separates disciplinary procedures, for example, suspension and expulsion, from grievance procedures, for example, restraining orders, housing, relocation. The resolution that you have been sent is the UA's Resolution 7. Basically, it says, step one, do nothing. Leave the campus code as is. Step two, if you believe that does not bring us into compliance, this is a resolution that's written to the president, then move all crimes of sexual harassment and sexual violence, all cases of sexual harassment and sexual violence, into a policy like Policy 6.4 and engage the relevant stakeholders on campus in the development of that policy. So I talked for very long, but if you have any quick thoughts on this now or questions, I'd be happy to take those. Seeing none, please communicate. Please do look at this. Like I say, this is very important, an especially concerning area of a graduate school survey that was conducted in 2008 is that a vast, vast minority, I think only 20% of graduate professional students, say that the sexual harassment policy is clear. I mean, that's not good. It's very important that, you know, people know what constitutes this policy, that people be engaged in the development of these policies when we have these opportunities. So I strongly encourage you to read over those attached documents, maybe not all in tons and tons of detail. That OCR letter is a little dense. And submit your comments to me as soon as you can, certainly by a week from today. The UA next meets about this and votes whether or not to pass the resolution next Tuesday at 4:30. That's March 13th. Finally, sesquicentennial planning. I sent an email about this. If you're interested, the deadline is Wednesday, March 7th. Please email Cindy Gray a few sentences about your interest. I think this is a wonderful opportunity. If you're around next year and the year after, this is going to be a really big celebration that takes place in 2015. Really a great opportunity to be involved in the inner workings of the graduate school and a celebration of Cornell, a place we all love and care about and so on and so forth. That's it for me. Other members of the executive, that's all. No more. John.
In that email that you sent out, are there arguments for and against?
In the email I sent out?
Yeah.
The email I sent out is just a shorter version of basically what I read. So the answer to that is no. I'm happy to talk to you about it more. Other questions? Other members of the executive?
Well, two quick things. I know you continue to hear about the work of the ad hoc committee on graduate teaching, advising, and mentorship, whatever exactly you call it. But anyway, we are moving full steam ahead to start the nominations process in about 2 weeks. And we're also looking to put together a luncheon for our presumed winner or winners. So if this is at all something you're interested in, still would like help on that. The other thing is I know that I've been mentioning the Big Red Barn dining options, but I've spoken with both Chris Korda at the Big Red Barn and also Dean Youth about the possibility of basically we would, I'm going to be working on a resolution for the next meeting that asks for the graduate school to basically allow the Big Red Barn to send out a proposal to seek a dining vendor from outside of Cornell dining. And if this is at all something that's interesting to you, please get in touch with me. I'll probably be meeting with Chris Porter in the next 2 weeks, and then that'll be on the docket for the next meeting.
Marquis? Excellent. Next on the agenda is appropriations. Chris? Nothing. Communications, Steve?
Not too many things to say. We're going to schedule our first meeting for the diversity focus group. We have three people voting for that right now. And the next issue of GPSA Buzz is going to go out to all direct professional students again. That's going to come out in about a little less than 2 weeks, so please give me your blurs. You know, we can only accommodate about four or five, even though the word of the middle is set for us. But the sooner you get them, the better.
Great. Next on the agenda, Finance Commission, Mia.
Not much to report. We've got our final meeting tomorrow night to distribute remaining funds, so the academic debt, and then the board next goal for the doing any budget for next year, and the summer funding. So I mentioned today to you previously, I can't confirm the PTS, we don't have my meeting tomorrow, but shortly after that, you'll be getting emails confirming deadlines.
Great. Thanks, Mia. student advocacy, Rebecca?
So the Council of the Long Meeting.
Hold on, Rebecca. Han?
Do I want to say something?
Yeah. Sorry,
I don't know.
Sorry, Rebecca.
What's the best way to deal with this, but you said that the amendment itself needs to be something that's done by the voting members of GPSA, so I thought I would bring it up, I guess.
Let's back up a second. So the funding guidelines for the GPSAFC, I'll just give you a little background here, prohibit alumni-related expenses. That is, shall we say, not the clearest language ever written. The standard FC interpretation of that line has been to prohibit the use of FC funds to go for alumni speakers, accommodation, housing, those sorts of things along with that. Enforcement may have not have been 100% consistent, but that's, you know, a function of both vagueness of language and a sort of change from time to time. But I think that the current FC's interpretation of that line is correct. If that line needs to change, that's an amendment to the funding guidelines, which is the same as the sort of amendments that we're exploring tonight. It is offered as a resolution. We debate it, discuss it, so on and so forth. It requires two meetings. Does that help? Clarify?
Yeah, so
some law school.
The amendment would have to be made first and then the discussion would be about it, or can the discussion be now and then amended based upon what it's discussed?
It would be ideal if it could be a part of a discussion on a resolution. Yeah, so this is the reason is that there are a number of, Han is our incoming voting member from the law school. There are a number of law school organizations, not exclusively law school, but there are a number of law school organizations that routinely bring in alumni as speakers. At the very least, it would be ideal if we clarified the line in that language. Whether or not we want to clarify it to say, shall prohibit all payments to alumni for any reason whatsoever, or whether we simply strike that language, that's a, you know, discussion that happens as part of funding guidelines. Does that help? Yes.
Question about the language. I don't
But so if the speaker, let's say,
I think the reason this is old language. It's been in. I actually called the previous FC chair to ask what his interpretation of this was. So it's at least 4 years old. It goes back longer than I think any of us in this room. I think the reason for the language was to prohibit groups from bringing their friends back on campus and then paying them money. I don't know, but my guess is that that's why the language was. It may be the case that language like that is no longer appropriate, but until such time as the guidelines are amended, the FC is in the position of simply enforcing the guidelines. Yes, Randa.
But I think in the past, at least mine was 1L and Randa's was 2L, it was interpreted to be just on merit. So you don't give money from the programming fund to be like, oh, this is $1,000 to speak for us. But we were able to pay for hotel, travel expenses, etc.
Right.
But then this year was the first year that we weren't able to pay. We never paid honorary, but travel expenses and lodging was the first year that we weren't able to bring alumni, even not even recent alumni, we're talking people that graduated in like 80s to come back, and that's why I think it caused the hysteric and really expected.
Sure. So the FC, the commission as a whole, not just the chair, has the prerogative to interpret the guidelines. If a group objects to that interpretation, which happens from time to time, then we have an appeals process, which then puts their application through actually the Appropriations Committee, who then looks over it and decides whether or not they believe the FC has erred in their interpretation of the guidelines. So basically, I would say if you have been denied funding for an alumni-related expense and you feel that that's incorrect, then it goes through the appeals process. The easiest way to clear it up, like I say, is an amendment to the guidelines. Yeah.
I'm trying to clarify, this might have been bad for you, because it used to get funding for those things, but in the past, my current interpretation of alumni expenses as including not only honorariums but travel and accommodation was enforced for other organizations in previous years. It just happens that your organization weren't affected. Because, as I said before, sometimes, you know, changeovers and, you know, when things get done, the annual budget day in April, when there's over 200 applications to look through in a single day, and we have to get people involved to, you know, have a throw in sitting on the FC all year, you know, that's how some of the discrepancies and changes in interpretation happen. But just to clarify, it's not that, you know, we just change things this year. Our enforcement.
Yeah. Ultimately, I would guess that the FC is to some degree neutral on the language of what can and can't be reimbursed, but they're in the position of enforcing the document as written. Yeah, we should definitely, if you have objections to the guidelines, great. Then we should have the discussion in the context of an amendment to the guidelines. Great. Moving right along. Sorry, Rebecca.
No problem.
Rebecca.
All right. The group of the law name that we mentioned at the beginning of the meeting, the University Council on Students' Mental Health and Welfare, meets twice a semester. And I was at the meeting with Joanne Vaughn, another graduate student. And it's a really great group. It's supervised by Professor Susan Murphy and a bunch of other very interested administrators on these issues. So we're presenting really good, exciting news where the topic of conversation is basically in our meeting. Opportunities for everyone in the room to meet all of the staff,
Great. Thanks, Rebecca. Next is Programming Board, YJ. Oh, sorry. Finally, Chris Heckman, who will give a report from the Faculty Senate Calendar Committee.
So, one of the other things that I do is I'm the liaison from the GPSA to the Faculty Senate. For the past 2 years, we've been in a process of reviewing our academic calendar, primarily as in response to certain mental health incidents that occurred, and I believe that our current and outdated academic calendar may have aggravated those issues. So for 2 years I've been meeting with these people and we've come up with a nice set of recommendations, and they're not too many in number, which is kind of amazing for having met for 2 years, three times a month. But very important ones that I'm here to present them to you, and I'm really interested in hearing your feedback, and the entire committee we need to hear your feedback, because these changes will be happening in some way or another unless people cry out against them and give us a reason for not doing them. So I have a short list of what those changes are, and you guys got the email about what the changes were. Regrettably, a very long document, one thing that showed
I put the two big tables for fall and spring are on the slides here.
So you can't see the top of this projector, unfortunately, but the image shows this is the fall 2013 hypothetical calendar in the new system, fall 2014, fall 2015, 2016, 2017. Once again, these are just fall. Thank you. That's great. So by looking at this, it might be difficult because you might not know what our current calendar is by heart. I certainly do, having studied it for 2 years, but regardless, I can name off to you basically the changes that are being done. These dates for the classes begin might look a little bit later in some years than what we currently have. The current calendar has it starting in about the third week of August. This in general puts us about the fourth week of August or somewhere around it. So we don't always start on Monday or anything like that. It's usually start on a Wednesday, but this is going to be changing to Tuesday start date. So also what we have is on that first week, it's Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, Friday, but apparently not that many classes are held on Fridays, so that Friday will be reclassified as a Monday. And Monday classes will be held on that Friday, the first week. After which, you will have a weekend, and then you will have another set of Monday classes. It's not that confusing. Other Ivy Leagues have pulled it off, and you like to think we're as intelligent as them, so you can do it. Okay, so Labor Day, no classes. That's what's happening right now. No change there. Fall break, no classes. Monday and Tuesday, no change there. Thanksgiving, right now we have a half day off. On Wednesday, Thursday, and Friday are completely off, and then we have the weekend. What we're suggesting to be done is Wednesday is completely a day off. It's no longer a half day, primarily because people pretty much didn't go to classes anyway. But there was instruction that was scheduled, and that was a problem. So we're getting rid of that, and we're turning it just into a three-day weekday break. As you can imagine, some senior staffers have wondered, well, are we just, at what point does this end? Are we going to give the entire week off at some point soon? Apparently, looking back in the archives, this is a really boring subject, but I need to throw out anecdotes. If you look in the archives, there used to be class on Friday after Thanksgiving, and there used to be class every Saturday up until about 30 years ago. It's a trend. Okay, so
by 2030,
class ends on Friday, and exams begin on Monday, and this is really where the biggest change in the fall semester comes out. What we have is the exam period usually has a sort of rest couple of days built into the front end of it, and those are called study week or whatever. We're suggesting that study week is cannibalized, and one of the days of study week gets moved into the middle of the exam period, and not more than two, but probably just one, of the regular study week days gets eliminated completely. The idea behind this is that study week is pretty much, in our opinion, not optimized. There are a lot of people that have no exams at some point or until the end, and so they have to sit around doing nothing. It tends to be a very dangerous period for students. We kind of want them to end that. Whereas we're still having about the same number of exam days, we're shortening the entire exam period on the whole by about one day. So I think that's pretty much all that there is for the fall. And if there are any comments on the fall calendar, I want to take them. But if I'm prepared just to move right along the screen if there are no comments. We can still comment on fall afterward if you want to reserve it.
Brian?
What's the reason for not just beginning the first week of classes on a Monday?
Okay, so this is a good question. There are a lot of contingencies with the calendar, one of which is advising periods. So usually when people move into the dorms, they have to move in on a Thursday or something like this. And inevitably what happens is they move in on a Thursday, there are a couple of days of orientation activities that we can't really touch, and there's this funny book project that I know nothing about, but apparently it exists. And then students have to go in to meet up with both advisors and academic and non-academic staff, but people that are still academic advisors, in order to set what their schedule is going to be and answer questions as to what the difficulty of their schedule is and what they're preparing for. The idea was that if we started classes on a Monday, that means the faculty members would have to advise on a Sunday or Saturday, and the faculty members on the committee, and having gone back and checked with their departments, were not entirely thrilled with coming in on to work on a Saturday and Sunday to execute that responsibility. As a result, we'll start on a Tuesday, and that advising will happen on a Monday. So that's the general idea behind it.
Liz?
So I was wondering if there's any discussion of the extension of the grading period. Thinking as a TA, you have that last exam that you have to turn it around.
Mm-hmm. Well, the grading period is no. There was no discussion. Just to be honest with you, the way that I've always seen it was that the grading period is actually quite long. You have something like 5 days usually in order to turn in a grade.
72 hours.
What?
72 hours.
You're supposed to do it within 72 hours. The last time that you can push a button to submit a grade is 5 days after the last exam is given. But there are departmental policies associated with it that usually fit, like, say, 48 hours. And there's faculty senate, I believe, faculty senate legislation that says 72 hours.
But if you think that that is onerous, then I can go to the faculty senate and say that and see if there's any support for extending that period. But I mean, we can talk offline about that if that's the case.
Other questions about? Oh, sorry.
Yeah. Concern with the no class on Wednesday coming for institutions where there wasn't Wednesday classes.
Yes.
On Thanksgiving,
yeah.
Does that turn into people just skipping the entire week? You worry about people skipping one day, you go to Wednesday, because they don't skip Tuesday, Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, all together. Which means, you know, so it's lose one day now or lose 2 days if you wish to hold the class.
So this was something that was discussed at length, and the final determination of our committee was that we are not here to sort of make exceptions for people that want to skip class. If they choose to skip class and want to skip class, they will skip class. And making it so that it's a 2 day week versus a 2.5 day week, in our opinion, if that's the bifurcation point after which somebody decides not to go to class, then we're not here to pander to these people. Right? I mean, like, we don't think that that's going to be the bifurcation point, but if it is, then we feel that that's not something we should question. So, in any case, we feel that Wednesday classes, having classes that are not happening on that entire Wednesday will actually have more benefits than they will than we're concerned about that group. Primarily, if you have no class on Wednesday, that means you can catch a flight on Tuesday or Wednesday, and that tends to be a lot cheaper if you want to go home, or you can get just a little bit longer to stay somewhere and you don't have to deal with the craziness that is Thanksgiving commute. So we felt that those are at least positive aspects.
Question?
Are there any academic policies already in place, or will they be put into place to prevent, say, professors from putting the final prelim of the course on December 6th and then the final on December 9th? So there will be like 2 days from that.
I beg your pardon? I can check to see whether that's a policy or not. I'm not familiar with all. I mean, the faculty senate legislation is very large, so I'm not familiar with any policy related exactly to this, but I can check for you.
Unless there are other questions, we'll move on to spring.
Okay, please do. Great. Sorry, if I don't write things down, I'll most certainly forget. The spring semester was a considerably more complicated piece to deal with, primarily because we were trying to find a new break that we could introduce into it. What the committee had primarily been referring to as a mental health break. And I'm saying that because that was basically the reason why this committee was formed. We needed to somehow break up the period between when classes began in late January and mid-March when we can take a spring break. So on this, we have provided one example of what could possibly happen. There's another one that I'm going to discuss briefly, but this is the one that seems to have the most support. So let's see. We have the same start date for this semester, as you can notice, January 20th, 19th. This is about when we start right now. This is different than what I reported on last year, that the possibility of starting earlier in any way. That's not being discussed. We're starting around the same time. The other pain at the end of the semester was that we needed commencement on Memorial Day weekend. There are multiple reasons as to why this is. There was some support for ending the semester a little bit early and maybe getting us out by early May or whatnot, but a lot of people said they like having commencement on Memorial Day weekend. It's easier for parents to travel. It's easier for facilities to turn this campus around from complete brown, gray, snowy winter to pretty green spring. Please give us money when you're an alumni sort of deal. That's why where we pivot. The later we are, the less likely, it's still going to be ugly. And so what we did was we introduced this mental health break in the middle of February, corresponding to President's Day weekend. And when I say we did, I mean, of course, we suggest doing everything that's a suggestion. So what that would involve is a break that is almost completely analogous to fall break, except happening in the spring. It would be a 2 day break, resulting in a 4 day weekend in the middle of the second month of the semester. And
Also, now that we have Monday and Tuesday off here, we're going to have a mismatch of how many days are going to be happening. There are going to be a lot more Wednesday, Thursday, Fridays than Monday, Tuesdays, because we just chopped off Monday, Tuesday. And remember that fall semester has this analogous, we want to create an analogous break like Thanksgiving. So what we did was, as a suggestion, no classes on Thursday and Friday prior to what is currently spring break. Spring break would be positioned in about the same place that it is right now, and it would not no longer be 9 days only, it would be 11 days. So that was basically the way that we dealt with this. The alternative to this plan was that instead of getting you Thursday and Friday off prior to spring break, we would make this February break, what is currently, or what would be next year, February 17th, 18th, we would give an entire week off in the middle of February, which is pretty crazy because that means we basically have 2 week-long breaks in the spring semester. This is something that we're kind of, you know, weighing, and we feel that at least this plan is a little bit less aggressive in terms of giving out breaks. But if there are people that really support having the whole five-day, like whole-week-long break, then I would like to hear it. I will give you primarily the reason why we decided not to put that one up on this slide is because it costs a lot of money to leave Ithaca, and if you had another break that was a week long, rather than making it sort of a mental health break, it might be, oh my god, all my friends are out of Ithaca and I'm really lonely here sort of break. And you know, if you can't go home or whatnot, maybe primarily for an international student, or if you know it just costs a lot of money and you don't have that kind of cash to throw around, this is not really a good option. So it might sound nice, but there are some externalities associated with it. And then we did the same magic that we did with the finals week. We sort of, you know, condensed it and added this day in the middle and all that. So comments on this semester? Again,
the question and comments. What's your two questions? So the days that you're adding to grade, are they all coming back to come to final week?
Yeah, pretty much. Finals week is being condensed. Right now, finals week is the longest of any of our peers, and we have, even when we're looking at, you know, how many classes we provide and how many students we have, it's still disproportionately short, or disproportionately long.
So you're not losing any class time at all?
No, in fact, in I failed to mention that we're actually adding one class day in the fall semester. Right now, I think it's 67 and a half and 69 days. Fall versus spring, and what we're moving it up is to, I think it might be 68 or 68 and a half and 69 days. That's in the proposal, and if you're concerned about that number, then look at the proposal.
And I was wondering if you had some undergraduates on the committee.
Yeah, we had two undergraduates on the committee, and they were active and giving feedback.
Okay, so we have about 3 minutes for questions. Kyle?
First of all, I think that the session is really good. It's not really as a there were sort of alarm bells among spring graduate students, oh my god, we're going to lose our winter break, and that study looks very reasonable. On the end of the exam period, first, it sounds like it could be a good thing. Definitely like the idea of close day not being the first day of the day weekend. Is that something that you guys have? I'm kind of surprised because of the mental health focus of, you know, the impetus for these changes, that it seems kind of counterintuitive that you would, because it seems like that's the time of the year when there is the most stress. And if you put the exam, you use a study day on Thursday.
No, I think I hear what you're saying.
Yeah.
Yeah. So the idea that this has been something that was also discussed, right now our exam period is exorbitantly long. And we look at our peers and we say, it could be that we're relieving stress by having a long exam period, and you know, maybe that's the case. But it might also be that we're adding stress by drawing out finals to the extent that it seems like they never end. It's funny saying it like that, and I don't mean to make light of it, but that is one possibility. So we looked at sort of like stress indicators of, you know, what if we have back-to-back exams, how can we condense it? It looks like a new algorithm that we're looking for in order to schedule exams would basically keep those stress indicators at or below the current level, even if we get rid of days and add this one day in the middle. So I think scientifically it looks like a better option.
So time just for three more questions. Aaron, Alex, Rebecca.
We have nobody, to my knowledge, that's from architecture on our committee, which means we don't have anyone in architecture on our committee.
It's been there for 2 years.
We won't be implementing this plan, regardless of the fact that it says spring 2014, spring 2015, et cetera. We probably won't be implementing things like changing study week, potentially, until a couple of years out, if not 3 or 4 years out. Initially, we were arguing about 5 years or 6 years out, but it seems like these changes aren't too substantive. We're keeping commencement where it is. So what I mean to say is that there are plenty of departments that are going to be affected by this, and we assume that they will somehow adapt to some of the changes that we're recommending. We will certainly give them enough time, and we will certainly try to work with them if they're talking about their problems, but this is how change is done on such a grand scale as a calendar. But I thank you for your comment. I will bring it back.
Alex?
I have a really great question. So here's senior days. Looks like 6 weeks or 3 days. How long is the senior celebration period for?
Okay, so it looks like it takes place over 3 days, and it used to be 5 days. There are numbers that have been posted in the Cornell Sun that were grossly erroneous. They said it was 9 days, and now it's 3 or something. Really what happened was they counted certain weekends that were on different ends and everything, and that's how they got up to it. And if you're going to count those weekends, then at least we're at 5, and they had 9, I guess. But there's also one other mitigating factor is that the last couple of days of exams in the spring semester will be purposefully loaded with entry-level or introductory-level classes, as in most seniors will not be taking exams during those 2 days, and they will retain their 9-day senior week. So if they're taking algebra, calculus 1 or something in the senior second semester, that's unfortunate. They might be slighted by this policy, but we're hoping that that's not the case.
Rebecca, final question.
I'm curious about the number of MCAs in this month. You said that the current plan is about 67 and a half and 69 in the spring. Mm-hmm. So I don't know if there's people first, how many days currently, and do those compare to our servers?
I believe that it was 67 and a half and 69, and we're moving closer by getting at 68 and 69, but like I said, those numbers are at the tip of my tongue. I believe those are what they are, but they're in the report.
Okay.
Second of all, peer groups, we are kind of in the middle of everyone else. Different states have different laws as to how many days of instruction and hours of instruction you need in order to award a credit. By this policy, we are sitting by the skin on our teeth by awarding credits. We still are doing it, and if we count up exam days, we just basically slide right in as we count exam days as instruction days, which is a funny thing. But in any case, that is what it is. We're trying to add more days, so to make us, compliant. We are compliant, but...
Great. I'm sure Chris would welcome further feedback via email. The plan, I believe, is that this has to be passed by the Faculty Senate as a recommendation and then ultimately signed off on by the Provost. It's not something that's going to, change this week to take effect in fall 2012 or anything like that.
Historically, this body has written a resolution to the effect of we accept these changes and we, say gung-ho to the Faculty Senate or something like this. So that might be forthcoming, depending on what that committee wants me to do.
Could be lucky number resolution 13.
Thank you.
Thanks, Chris. Unless there's any objection, we're going to make a slight change to the agenda. We'll do the election number 3 after R11, so we'll just swap those two. The reason is that it takes some time to count the ballots, so we want to have something to do while the ballot counting goes on. It's not going to affect the results of anyone who can vote or not vote. Whoever's elected, they will start next meeting. Seeing no objection, we move now to Resolution 11. So we're familiar with this now. Both of these, R11 and R12, require prior notice, which means that we can do everything to them right now except actually pass them. So they can be amended, they can be whatever. They can be postponed if you want, but I suggest not doing that. And so on and so forth. All the usual parliamentary stuff except an actual vote on passage, which will come in 3 weeks. Let me pull up the resolution. So a lot of this stuff is maybe arcane is a good word. Good bedtime reading. How about that? You know, striking section 101 and inserting A. Come on, Evan. Isn't that a little pedantic? I mean, really. Really. Needed to be consistent. Come on. Anyway, so most of this stuff is, in my view, clarifying the policy as it stands right now. There are no substantive policy changes except clarifying who can vote, who can't vote. I removed the article that told you that the number of votes is the number of votes, which I couldn't understand. So I struck that. I mean, it's like, yeah, the number of people voting is the number of people voting. We don't need to put that in the bylaws. Anyway, the salient point here, the substantive point, is the amendments to Appendix A of the criteria. And these are these sort of, for lack of a better word, the contract that we enter into, or that byline-funded organizations agree to abide to as a condition of receiving funding from us. The only substantive amendment, I rewrote the section on Cornell Cinema because, well, I'm a pain in the neck, I guess, but it doesn't change the meaning, it just is clearer. The only substantive change is the appending of point 4 to subsection G of Appendix A. That is, that reads in this resolution, the Sloke Day Programming Board shall seek to maintain the policy of not charging graduate and professional students, but if that proves impossible, shall charge no more than $10 per graduate professional student ticket. So that's basically the presentation on the agenda, just to lay out, the presentation on the resolution, to lay out the way this works. You can add things to the document. So if you're looking at the section on athletics, say, and I don't know, you think that, I don't know, an athletics, whatever, should come with, I don't know, a free pat on the back or something, then you can offer an amendment to this document that would add that passage. So this, that's the parliamentary term is, that's germane. That amendment is germane to the purpose of this resolution. You can also offer an amendment striking any particular passage of this resolution or changing the wording of any particular passage of the wording resolution, except the one striking section 101 and inserting A. The chair will not entertain any amendments on that. I slaved over that passage. So with that said, we have 10-ish or so minutes, 10, 15 minutes to discuss this. Anybody can speak as usual. I'll favor voting members and field representatives in my recognition, but community members can speak as well. We're in formal debate. I'll try to keep comments to about a minute. Okay. Bill, thank Preston.
Strong
Johnny's
agreeing with the Sculpt Day language, but proving it impossible, term impossible, seems like it's not really the correct term that should be used there. I think it would be $10 more.
May I suggest that an appropriate course of action would be suggesting an amendment?
So I guess I would suggest an amendment to remove that whole section.
Remove section C?
Yeah.
And not put anything in there? May I suggest that we should at least have that that there is an issue in the current policy in that we don't specify any sort of cost relationship with slope day. So I think this is my impartial opinion as chair, that we should at least have some language in there that says something. Either it should say something like admission must be free or admission must cost less than $10. So if you wanted to strike something, you could just change it to read admission shall be free.
I would say something like freshman students can get rid of the thought if proves impossible.
So the Slope Day Programming Board shall seek to maintain the policy of not charging graduate students.
But I mean graduate students.
Sorry?
Should not charge more than $10 for graduate students. Yeah, or should not charge more.
So striking, but if that proves impossible, and inserting, or should not.
Shall not, yeah.
Okay, there's an amendment on the floor. Is there a second? Seconded by Steve. Their discussion on the amendment. Yeah, just give me a second. This is the original language. It would change to or shall charge no more than. How about that? Is that a fair statement? Okay. The amendment is made and seconded. Is there discussion on the amendment? Preston?
Just sort of a logical case, it would be weird to have an or statement in that statement because it just now sounds like they have a choice of which one to enforce. And we have a preference to do the first one first. And I don't think I have a right to the amendment, but I could suggest that somebody else make an amendment saying that failing to do so shall charge no more than $10 for graduate students. Because it would provide indigence on the first half of the clause.
So there's how about this? There's an amendment to the amendment. I'll just accept it. How about this? Or failing that. How about that? So that's an amendment to the amendment. Let's see if we can make this quick. Is there any objection to that amendment to the amendment? Seeing none, the amendment is amended. We're now in discussion on this amendment, this language. Comments? Nicole?
I feel like we should have a little bit more discussion about whether or not we should even allow the charging of $10 for graduate student ticket. Given the discussions that we've had previously and the history of Slope and, you know, the history of our relationship with Slope Day, I really think that the preference should be for free admission for the activity fee.
So how about this? The amendment as it stands right now is not an enormous change. It's basically an adjustment of the wording saying that we prefer free admission, but if not, then here's a dollar figure that you shall not exceed. How about, unless there is more comment on the wording of the passage, we just vote on the change in the wording? And then we can go back into discussion on amendments to the whole resolution, one of which might include changing the $10 to $750. Is that okay? Is there objection to moving to a vote on this amendment? Seeing none, those in favor of the amendment, please raise your green placard. Those in favor of this language. Sorry, you can't read this thing because my text editor is enormous. How about this? And I can probably make the font bigger, too. Oh, I deleted it. Oh, no. So we're voting on this language, just replacing the stuff at the top with the stuff that's highlighted. Those in favor, please raise your green placard. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, 13, 14, 15. Those opposed? 1, 2. The vote of 15 to 0, the amendment passes. 15 to 2, pardon me. 15 to 2. The amendment is adopted. Ah! Unbelievable. Sorry. I'm a bit of a word whiz over here. Did I get that right? Good. All right. We resume formal debate on the resolution. Amendments, of course, still in order. Steve. Well, sorry, who asked that? Carl. Yes.
This is only binding the slope they accept some money.
That's of course. We don't. That's true. We have no power over them if we're not giving them any money.
So it's the $4 and whatever cents per student or whatever we need to be calculated back then, and then we appropriated them plus that, you know, they can't.
That's $13.50 mm-hmm. per attendee. Yeah, that's true. For comparison, this is what the language says for Cornell Cinema. Shall not increase ticket prices without the approval. Chris.
So there are a couple things. I think that we need to have a number in this document, primarily because neither I nor anyone on the nor any committee of the GPSA should be given the to be passed the buck to make this sort of decision, because this really affects more than just a couple of people that perform on a committee based on my strong recommendations. That being said, this is also something that we sort of need to grapple with, because if we get rid of this kind of language and say they must provide us free admission, for instance, which is what I feel some people are leaning towards, I strongly doubt that will actually happen. And more likely money would be rejected and we would have no formal relationship with Slope Day going forward as a matter of this kind of tickets or needing to have a seat on the executive board, although they volunteered that they would continue that practice or anything to that extent. So I think that it's just trying to put this decision in perspective because I feel like we might be going down that route. If we say $0, then I doubt that we're going to get the kind of discount admission that we're looking for. If we put in a number, then perhaps we can negotiate what that is. But this, I really believe that from a legislative standpoint, this body needs to make that decision. I'm sorry. I mean, I really wish it could be that for me.
Kyle?
Yeah, I have a motion to strike all tests in this paragraph C after charging back for professional students. So strike the work day staff, so charge no more than $10 per professional student ticket.
Strike that. So shall seek to maintain the policy of not charging graduate and professional students.
And then that's what
right, of course. I'm a whiz over here. Look at that. There's an amendment on the floor. Is there a second on the amendment?
Second.
Seconded by Nicole. Is there discussion on the amendment?
You can formal debate against it.
You may certainly speak however you like.
Okay. Well, being that usually how these things are done, you know, one of us speak is important.
Yes, I agree.
So I'm going to speak against, assuming that you have ceded to our ability to speak for. If we do this, then the way that I see this working is probably not in the interest of the GPSA, because this would be essentially what we had had before, which didn't say anything about how Slope Day needed to give us free admission. The Slope Day program is more needed to give us free admission to Slope Day, which means that we could give them $350 and they could still charge us $50 for a ticket. Of course, you know, they were reasonable and honorable people and they never did that to us, and I believe that would be how it is going forward, but
they would charge us something if we put this. We would have to know who's no bargaining power or what that number would be. It could be 15, it could be 20, whatever. So I really think if we wanted to be conservative, then we could say $10, $15, and they probably wouldn't charge us that much, or maybe they would if that's what they're comfortable with. But I really don't think we should get rid of a maximum cap as to ticket prices.
So maybe if I can read into what you're saying, an amendment that might more accurately accomplish Kyle's point might be something like, instead of shall seek to maintain, something like shall not charge graduate and professional students, shall not charge admission. Then of course, as multiple people have pointed out, Slope Day has the right to reject our funding, not get the $350, and charge whatever they want, because they have no contractual obligation with us. Was that your intention, Kyle? Okay. Further comments on the amendment? We'll spend about 5 more minutes on this resolution, then we need to move to the election. We'll have lots of time to discuss this in 3 weeks. Yevgeny, then Marquise.
I just have a clarification question. So
Eric.
If we keep this, does that mean they can charge us and still accept our activity fees, right? So it's $10.
They can charge us up to $10 and still take the $350.
So how does
the language passes as is without passing Kyle's amendment?
So how does the $10
I've rolled the dice. I put this out here as a document for discussion. Feel free to suggest 5 or 50. Eric?
It may be the way I'm interpreting it, but I feel like this sort of puts the ball in their court. Maybe if we were to replace the highlighted section and maybe not increase the ticket price without our consent, that might, I don't know if it would give us any power back to this body to say to their rejection or their offer of a ticket price a little bit more.
Right.
I feel like that.
That sounds like an amendment to me, but it doesn't sound like an amendment to this amendment germane enough to do right now. So let's keep the comments on Kyle's amendment. Next on my list is Marquise. Marquise?
Okay, so I wanted to speak in support of the amendment. I wholeheartedly agree with what Eric said. I think it does put the ball back in the Slope Day Programming Board's court because, I mean, I think that we've made the good faith effort, and then it'll be sort of their decision whether or not they want to exclude graduate students from this community event or not. And I'd rather for the headline to read Slope Day Programming Board rejects graduate students from Slope Day than the grad students have to be charged a certain amount of money to participate in the Cornell event. That's sort of where I am on this, and I'm totally in support of it.
Alex?
Hey, thanks for that question. So I know these $10 is bigger than just hold the dice or not. How much?
Because I would have to roll 2 dice.
How much money is supposed to ask for that we projected?
You mean how much was in their application for byline funding? They asked for $6.
So
the numbers are apples and oranges. It would be $6 from every graduate and professional student, so 6 times roughly 6,800 or so, whereas this is just people who attend. Oh, sorry. Chris?
The last year's Slope Day Programming Board Executive Committee asked for $6, but this year's Executive Committee said that they were comfortable with the number that was around $450.
Yes, apologies. Thank you.
So I have a question about Kyle's proposed amendment. It seems to me removing that last sentence suggests that the programming board could potentially, although they probably wouldn't, take the money and seek to maintain but not maintain and then charge whatever they want. Like, take the money and then charge whatever they want.
Yes, I think that's a fair interpretation, which is why I suggested some alternate wording. Liz, next on my list.
Whether it's the $10 for half the alumni rate for a ticket or some other sort of warning, is the exact amount that we're concerned about and specifying that. That's one issue. But I do think that we need to try to provide some sort of, if I'm hearing it right, we need to have some sort of limitation for the committee or the guidance.
It's 6:45. We need to conduct an election. We also need to make sure that we at least discuss Resolution 12. Unless there is any objection, I'm going to table this for now, which means that we can come back to it at the end of the meeting if we still have time. I'm free all night, so I'm happy to keep going. And then, of course, again, we're not voting on passage today. We do, however, need to make sure that we get a vote on the amendment as it stands right now. Which would be striking everything from or failing that, everything from the comma before or failing that up to but not including the period at the end of the sentence, just to be clear. So unless there are strong objections to that, we'll vote on that. Seeing no objections, green placards, those in favor of the amendment striking this language, please raise your placards. Those in favor, one. Two. Those opposed? One, two, three, four, five, six, seven, eight, nine, 10, 11, 12, 13. The vote of 2 to 13, the amendment is not adopted. Without objection, Resolution 11 is tabled. We move now to the next item on our agenda, which is the election of an at-large member. Sorry to keep things moving so quick. If one of the seats representing a division of the graduate school becomes vacant during the term of office, that seat is thrown open at large, and a member may be elected from among the entire GPSA membership, every graduate and professional student. A special election shall be held. That's right now. Professional school seats don't apply because they do their own elections. Everybody with a placard gets to vote. Are there any nominations? You can nominate yourself. If there are no nominations, then I guess it just gets vacant. Whoops, copied and pasted that from a slide that was a few months old. One nomination, if there are more nominations, so on and so forth. Everybody should have one of those little placard witch-a-ma-doodles. Are there nominations? Eric?
I would nominate
Giovanna. Giovanna, do you accept? Chris?
I'd like to nominate William Kreuser.
William Kreuser. William accepts. Marquise?
I'd like to nominate John Hill.
Jonathan
Hill.
Oh, hi, Jonathan. Jonathan Hill, do you accept?
Yeah.
Sean?
I would nominate Mitch Payne.
Mitch Payne. Mitch, do you accept? Sorry.
Deaf.
Yes.
I want to nominate Liz.
Liz Newberry. Liz, do you accept? Did I spell that right?
Yeah.
I did. Further nominations? Are there any further nominations? Seeing none, nominations are closed. Each candidate in the order of their nomination shall have 1 minute to speak, and then everybody who has a green placard or a blue placard should have received a little sheet of paper. You can cast your vote. So I will recognize Giovanna first for 1 minute.
So integrating some students,
wages and involving people and it has been a challenge.
Excellent. Next, Bill.
I'm Bill Kreiser. I'm a second-year PhD student in horticulture. I currently serve as a member of the Appropriations Committee, and so last semester I spent a great deal of time with these gentlemen looking over all the biomass funding applications. I really enjoy working with DPSA and coming to these meetings, and I like to have a more active role in being able to vote. If I express my opinions usually with these meetings, I would really appreciate your vote.
Thanks, Bill. Next, Jonathan.
Hi, I'm Jonathan Hill, first-year teacher student. I'm still starting to get to know how everything works here, and I listen a lot as I've been attending meetings. One of the things I would like to get a little bit better at is learning some of the history and kind of getting some of these nerdy anecdotes into the conversation, because I really enjoy how that enlivens the debate and kind of gives a little bit of a historical perspective about what we're doing here. And I'm very much so appreciative of your support.
Thanks, Jonathan. Mitch?
Thanks. So I'm a first year city and regional planning student. We do our elections in the late fall, and I'm following in Sean's footsteps. And one of the things that I would like to do as a more active voting member of GPSA is use my relationship with the various community organizations that I work with. I think I've expressed before in here, but I'm a member of the Citizens Advisory Committee for TCAT, and I know that there have been a couple different transportation-related issues that have been brought up to GPSA, or to GPSA, and so I'd really like the opportunity to better expound on those relationships with the community and help us all with our opinions to TCAT, our relationships with various other city departments, so I would like to help with that as well.
Thanks, Mitch. Finally, Liz.
Hi, I'm Liz. I'm from the Department of Communications. I'm a second year grad student. And I guess launching off of that, one of my key interests is and reaching out to our constituents and our graduate students. As a field rep for the department, I've been really active in trying to get involvement from our students, trying to make sure that they're updated, and also trying to meet them one-on-one and face-to-face in order to get their feedback on some of the issues that we're looking at here. I'm also going to be helping Steve and Marquise on the diversity committee. My background is in nonprofit grassroots organization for diversity issues, so that kind of speaks to my expertise. I'm also trying to get more involved with Cornell as a whole and understanding more about Cornell University. I'm taking a Cornell history course about Cornell at the moment and trying to appeal to the student body as a whole.
Thanks, Liz. Thanks to all five of our wonderful nominees. If you can please write your name, pardon me, their name, legibly, on the little flip of paper, and Amy will collect those from you. Thanks, everybody. So now we'll move very quickly to the next item on our agenda, which is Resolution 12. Chris Heckman.
So you've heard a lot from me already, and I'm sorry for boring you. But there is one last thing that I have to add to tonight's business, and it's about the internal spending of the GPSA and its committees, and how we can keep track of all that. So this is basically just a little bit of housekeeping. I've been asked multiple times throughout this year, how much money do we have, how much money does my committee have, etc. I met with the Office of the Assembly last week, in order to sort of clarify what the process should be in the future when approached with such questions, and as a result, I've drafted several changes to the bylaws, one of which adds an entirely new section, which can be seen in the last, here it is, line 44 and beyond. Basically, all of this has to do with saying, we spend money, and committees need to know how much they're spending, and there are some circumstances about which we need to think about, or that we need to think about and primarily prepare against. For instance, what happens if there's a budget underrun and like a committee spends more money than they actually have. what is the procedure for that? That's happened a couple of times in the past several years. What happens when a committee doesn't know how much money they've spent, and how can that sort of be explained? And so what this does is it gives a few more responsibilities to the Appropriations Committee chairperson in order to interface directly with the Office of Assemblies in order to get that information through access to their spending database, basically their financial accounting system. This is not a, I don't think there's anything contentious in this resolution. And as a result, I'm not going to waste people's time, but I would be happy to give explanation as to why something is written.
So we'll take a couple of minutes if there are questions. YJ?
Yeah, so thank you for asking that question. This is one of the topics of conversation that was had with the Office of Assemblies last week. That has been agreed upon. And the reason why I put this in the bylaws is not to tell the Office of Assemblies to get that person access, but more to remind the next chairperson that they need to engage the Office of Assemblies in order to get that access, because it is being offered, and that is the way, that's the linchpin behind all of this. Without having someone in our organization that knows what our spending is, that means we need to interface with the Office of Assemblies each time that we want to figure that out, because that's a cumbersome process, and I'm trying to alleviate that.
I think that one of the big changes behind this is that the new accounting system allows us to track per committee expenditures, whereas previously the GPSA's internal budget was just in one large account, so you couldn't see, oh, appropriations has spent $300 of their $400 or whatever. You could just see that the GPSA had spent X whatever thousand out of its X whatever thousand things. So this is taking advantage of that. Nicole?
Actually, my question was mostly related to the tracking system. But also, I guess, could you clarify what you meant by provide institutional memories?
I did not have that. That was there before.
That was there as in... So
the bold was because I think the number, I meant to bold the number. I had to read...
We probably can't let you
I see.
Do
okay.
that.
Yeah, under which... Yeah. So I did not have that. And what I imagine it means, if I may be so forward, is that the Office Assembly has staff that sticks around longer than we typically do, and they know more about what has caught us in the past.
Kristen? So moved. Is there any objection? Seeing none, so ordered. See how I did that? Those of you who want to be president next year, that's a good technique. Meeting is extended till 7:07. Are there further comments on this resolution? If not, we have... There certainly can be, but just to give you a heads up, Mitch is going to speak briefly, I'm sure his designee is going to speak briefly, and then we can come back to the Resolution 11 if you want to continue that discussion. So if there are no further comments on Resolution 12, seeing none, I'll recognize Mitch Payne in open forum.
Great, thanks. I want to cede my time to David Kay, who is... the Cornell Regional
Community and Regional Development Institute Development of the
Thank you. I did not remember that. And he is also the Vice Chair of the Conference of Planning Committee for the City of Ithaca, and has asked myself and a number of my colleagues to help organize a few input sessions, and I'm going to let him explain the whole process a little bit more.
I'll try and be really brief. I think most of you probably know, I was a graduate student here a long time ago, and it took me a while to figure this out, but you all do live in a city, or a town, or a village, probably in Conference County. They all have governments. And the city of Ithaca right now is in the middle of trying to update what's called a comprehensive plan, which planning students in the audience will know a lot about, probably. A comprehensive plan is really to provide a vision for the future development of the city, future preservation of the city. And there's a committee of about a dozen or so people that's already on it. I'm vice chair of it. And we're trying to figure out how to have input from as many different constituencies as possible, who not not only live in the city, but have a stake in the city in one way or another. So Mitch has said he has some ideas on how we might go about getting more input. There is a website, if you Google City of Ithaca, there's already a website you can go on and give your input to individuals. You'll see on the homepage of the city, there's something called a comprehensive plan link. You go to that form and fill out online, but we're kind of looking for other ways to get more kind of group kind of input from students and possibly other people that could have ideas about how to connect to it.
So what we're thinking is right after GCSA in 3 weeks, on March 26th, we will do a student public input session for the comprehensive plan for the city of Ithaca. And we'll do that probably somewhere in City Hall or Milton Hall, which is the brand new one that's connected. And I do that because I'm sure most graduate students are interested and probably live down in the city someplace and would have valuable input and opinions on how we think it should grow for our graduate students or if we plan to stick around. So I will probably provide information to Evan to have him let everyone know the details. So it will supposed to be on March 26th at 7:30 afterwards.
Great. Thanks, Mitch. Are there any questions about the comprehensive plan info session? I imagine attending the session is a good way to find out more information. We'll email it out when it's confirmed. Time, date, place, all of that. Unless there are further items for open forum. Seeing no further items in open forum, I have the results of the election. The winner of the election is Liz Newberry. Congratulations, Liz. So I guess you can consider your term beginning as soon as this meeting ends, when Yevgeny will no longer be a voting member. Congratulations. We have 6 more minutes in the meeting. We'll go back now to Resolution 11. To remind you where we were, the amendment to strike this language failed. So we're now at basically the original resolution, except we changed some words in here. Brian.
I want to propose Eric's amendment to use a language similar to the language that we have for Cornell Cinema. We can just use exactly that language, actually. So that what they wrote for programming board shall not or charge graduate and professional students without the express approval of the student members. Just copy and paste that.
Well, all I would say is that what's going to happen is that they will then come to the GPSA and say, can we charge graduate and professional students? And then we'll have this debate again.
Right. But it's an amendment that would take feedback into account about allowing people to continue having their negotiations, wouldn't set an arbitrary dollar limit, but would hold them accountable to talking with us about the differences.
Gotcha. So there's an amendment on the floor. Is there a second to the amendment? Seconded by Steve. Let me just copy and paste some stuff. So that's the existing text. It would change to this. Is that a fair statement of your amendment, Brian?
Sure.
The amendment is moved.
Amendment.
Moved and seconded. Moved by Brian, seconded by Steve. We're now in discussion on the amendment. Comments for or against? Chris?
I would speak out against this amendment, primarily because right now we have the ability to say about how much money we're willing to spend and an idea of that as to whether that's acceptable to slow pay from revenue board. Here's what happens if we get a number that they think that we think is unreasonable from them, then they decide how much it's going to be. We vote it down and then we get rid of their funding. Whereas right now we have the ability to say it can't be more than this, and then we get to essentially punt a very difficult decision into a different group. We say, we don't want to charge more than $10, and they say, that's unacceptable, we're not going to take your money, versus them saying, we're going to charge you $15, and then us saying, that's unacceptable, we're not giving you money. You see what I'm saying? I think it puts us in a strategically disadvantageous position, which is why I think that we should put a dollar figure down.
Matt?
Yeah, so I definitely think combination would be possible to put both in where you have a cap at whatever that net amount is, $10, but also have the language where you're still negotiating. We'll have sort of both ideas in there, but also have a cap so that they know not to come in with a ridiculous number.
Yeah, that's the question. Is it germane or should we vote on this amendment as it stands? I'll think about that more, Rob.
Would that just be instead of replacing the top section 4, it would be like section 5 below it? Would say that the slope vehicle government will shall not charge the tax removal?
You mean add an additional 5?
Yeah.
By appending and appending 5 before. Oh, no, that's not going to work. Up here. Appending 5 before charging grad prof students shall obtain the express approval. I don't know if there's another kind of approval, but that's what it says. GPSA. So this would be appending a 5 after the 4 that's already in there. Let's deal with the current amendment as it stands right now. Sorry, I've not been very good at keeping the speakers list. Our meeting time is going to expire in like 30 seconds. Is there a motion to extend the meeting? Moved by Brian. Is there a second for the motion? Seconded by Eric. Is there any objection? Seconded by 10 minutes. That'll take us to 7:17. Seeing no objection. We can go as long as we have quorum. So you can leave if you have to, of course, but we need to have at least 10 voting members in the room or we can't do anything. Good. So we're in debate. Ignore this stuff. I'm going to keep it there because I'm not bright enough to come up with that twice. We're in debate on this amendment. The first hand I see is Eric. Other hands I'll write down.
If this allows them to set the price as they wish and reject it, what sort of way does putting a dollar value in there have? You know, if this isn't binding for anything, what does the dollar have?
Well, what would happen, so say we adopted this language as written, and the Slope Day Programming Board said, we want to charge $12, then we can say, you're in violation of the contract, we're taking your money back. That's the only way that any of this is enforceable. In that it's a contract that stipulates what they agree to in exchange for receiving money. So it's any language we put in here, we could say, I don't know, whatever we want. Any language in here is only enforceable in as much as, yeah. YJ, did you have your hand? I can answer that if you like. This document expires after 2 years. So this document, that's why we're doing this discussion now. Not because we don't like Noel and John, but because this document expires on May 31st and we need a new set of byline procedures and criteria for the 2 years after that. Steve and then Carl?
I guess there's a little bit of confusion. What's preventing this? So I still don't really understand the difference as they're expressed about putting dollar value and not putting dollar value. It seems like either way, whoever's in charge of the appropriation committee still has the power to say, if you charge too much, you have to do money. Is that correct?
That's not how I would understand it is, so if we have two options, let's say one option is shall not charge graduate students without the express approval, and the other option is shall charge no more than $10. in the former scenario, the one where they need approval, slope day meets, they come back to the GPSA and say, we've got a figure, $5, yay or nay, or we've got a figure, $15, yay or nay, and then we would have to vote to accept that or vote to reject it. If we vote to reject, again, the only penalty we can enforce is that we take away their funding. In the other situation, the one that specifies a dollar value, we save ourselves having to continue having this debate. Basically, we can say, here's a maximum figure that we're comfortable with. If you can't work within that figure, then we have a problem. But it makes the debate internal. I think that's what Chris was saying before. Carl?
So I guess I'm speaking for the amendment, because I think, I agree that we need to limit, if so they feel that they need to charge, I think we need to limit how much they charge. However, I don't know if $10 is appropriate. I don't know what number is appropriate, and I think that decision should be made within the context of what Slope Day is actually offering graduate students. But, a year from now, what is on the Slope Day Canvas plan? Who are they bringing? And so I think the amendment puts us in a situation where we should be discussing this next year. If they want to charge us, tell us why we should be charging us.
If I may.
Even if $10 is a reasonable amount, even if $10 is a reasonable amount, some people may think that. I think in any sort of charging situation, we should be coming against them.
I think all I would insert is that I think we owe it to Slope Day the same way we owe it to all our byline-funded organizations to give them budget certainty as soon as possible. So if what we're saying is, come back to us next spring when you've got a sense for what Slope Day 2013 is going to look like, and we'll decide then whether you get to charge us, then they're not sure whether they can count on the $350 for graduate students or not. I imagine they want to know whether they can count on that money as soon as possible, especially after this Slope Day. But we, of course, only have a couple more meetings to decide this. I saw John Pan, then Chris.
I speak in favor for keeping the 10 in. One in terms
You're speaking against the amendment.
Well, I'm speaking for the $10. I'm not sure if that's for or against anymore.
The amendment is to get rid of this and to insert this. Against the amendment.
So I do want that $10 in because, one, it shows them where we think an unreasonable amount is. In turn, that would expedite any kind of negotiation. And it also helps us in terms of a benchmark of if we were to go with a negotiation. By just arbitrarily doing don't charge us, we don't want to be charged anyway. Now, this at least gives us some form of leverage going into that discussion, but that's it.
Thanks, John. Chris?
So I don't think that we should try to negotiate with the price of year to year, kind of, because we don't have any other group, actually. So, for instance, concert commission puts on a bunch of concerts, they decide how much they're going to charge for tickets. They still get the money that you're offering them, they can charge the growing amount of tickets. But the idea is that they're going to charge it so that they can optimize how many people are going to buy tickets. And I think that really all we're trying to do is put in a cap of how much money we think we should be putting into the pool after we've already put in, a dollar amount of heads. So philosophically, we treat this group significantly differently than any other group, which is really how we've been treating them so far, but I think also a departure from just basic business practices.
Marquise?
Yeah, how will the GPSA monitor that they are seeking to maintain the policy of not charging graduate students?
If I may guess at a response, it would be by sending a member to their board meetings,
okay,
which we already have a right to do, and we would maintain that right.
Okay.
Next on my list is Sean.
I would like to speak against the amendment and say that the amendment is unnecessary. I think that the based on what the situation is, this is and given that it wants to start with you, then it feels the immediate situation to put it in the way.
Kyle?
I have a vote on the
Is there a second? Is there any objection? In other words, are there people who have a burning desire to speak on this amendment? Seeing none, the question is on the amendment, striking this and inserting this. those in favor of inserting this language, replacing it with the highlighted passage in favor of the amendment, please raise your green placards. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7. Flaggers down. Let's try that again. Those in favor? 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8. Those opposed? 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. With a vote of 8-5, the amendment is adopted. Are there further comments and formal debate on the resolution? Marquis, how about this? A motion to adjourn the meeting?
No, I'll move to close debate on the resolution.
Well, this is the last thing on our agenda.
Well, okay.
We can't vote on it today.
Oh, that's right. I'll move to adjourn.
Move to adjourn. Is there a second? Seconded by Carl. Is there any objection? No? I know there aren't very many of us left, but a reminder that our next meeting is 3 weeks from today because of spring break. We get to do this again. We get to pass Resolution 12. And say congratulations to Liz.
This has been a production of Cornell University. On the web at cornell.edu.